Thanks for coming. Just taking the register in my mind, seeing us here. Yes, you must be gluttons for punishment, but thank you for coming. So this is the second part of a session that we started back in July, it was. And I blame you for this, because it was supposed to be one session, and there was a body of opinion which said, can we do some more on this? Can we carry on? Now, you may not have been one of those that said that, but I noticed some of those that did say that are not here tonight, so that's... but if you were one of those, this is your punishment for saying, let's pursue this topic a bit more. So seeing that some of you were there in July, what can you remember?
Daniel.
Ah. One-word answers are fine, but can you elaborate a little bit? Is it? Yeah, so he's reading his notes now. So when I said, what can you remember, I didn't mean what can you read. Okay, I mean, yeah. Okay, that's right. I won't prolong this. So what we're going to do tonight is push that a little bit further. So we were thinking last time about how church and Christians and we as individual disciples of Jesus interact with the world that we live in, using this word culture to describe the world that we live in. Culture being often and simply defined as the way we do things. So there's a set way of doing things in the world that we live in, and how do we interact with that? So we were thinking about the idea of church being a distinct group set in the middle of a big wide world and working out how the relationship works between who we are and what we're about and who other people are and what they're about. And in particular, our calling in some way, shape, or form, to influence and shape culture. Again, very well-known verses, but Jesus said to his disciples that they were to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. Clearly, there was an expectation that the disciples of Jesus, the church, would have an impact on the world in which they were set. They weren't to retreat into some sort of monastic community, but they were to engage in some way. And we finished the last session with a diagram from a book by a man called Tim Keller, if you remember. I hope it doesn't bring back any painful memories. But he identified four ways that different Christians try and do this thing of engaging with culture. And there are examples of this around Christian organizations and churches and historic denominations, of different ways of trying to engage with the world around them. And just very, very simply, by way of catching up and then moving on, these were the four ways. So the first was to view the kingdom of God and the kingdom of the world as both legitimate kingdoms, but separate. There's a kingdom of God, there's a kingdom of this world, and God runs the world by the organizations that are in the world, politics and so on. Remember, Paul in Romans said that the state is God's servant to do us good, that there's a sense that there is an ordained culture out there which God is part of, but it's a separate one to church culture. And we engage in that, in this view, by just going to our daily work and doing it as well as we can. We don't try and change it so much, because we live in the kingdom of God, but part of our life is spent as kingdom of God people in the kingdoms of this world. And whilst we're there, we try and live as honestly as we can as kingdom of God people, without any great expectation that we're going to change anything very much. So that's one view. I'm not going to elaborate these again, because you already had 1 month on this. So the second view was that we do need to change the world. We need to address the issues of injustice and hardship and famine and the other issues in the world that God is not happy with. And we need to show that the gospel is relevant to the real world, and we need to bring hope and light and justice and so on to the world. And this trajectory often is not too concerned about evangelism or letting people know about Christ or bringing people into the church. It's more, let's just get on and make the world a better place. So often liberal Christianity is identified with this view, although not exclusively. No concern really about seeing people come to faith, but the important thing is we just need to feed them, we need to clothe them, we need to help them, we need to get them out of slavery and so on. So that's a different sort of mindset again. The third, which Tim Keller calls the countercultural one, is to say that actually this view has a slightly bigger distance, if you like, between church and world, and sees the church as God's primary intention, to build the church. I will build my church and the gates of death will not prevail against it. That God's primary concern is to build a body of people who show what his life looks like, who model something of his grace and kindness and goodness within itself so that the watching world can see there's a different way to live. So this way puts quite a lot of emphasis on the church, but not the church as doing churchy things, but the church as a community of people who are yielded to Jesus Christ, living like a bit of a beacon in the middle of the world. So if people want to find out what justice and kindness and goodness and generosity looks like, there's an example that God's pitched into the world. And so this, the way we serve culture here is not so much by engaging with it, although of course we do because we all live in the culture, but it's by really trying to build a distinctive community that other people can look at and see God through. This view really believes the church is the body of Christ. And if God's going to do anything in culture, he's going to do it through his body, and through his body being just like Jesus. Yeah, there's all this ring any bells. The fourth view, Tim Keller calls the transformation view. And this would be the view where we try to influence culture by infiltrating it. So a classic example of this would be the whole Christians in politics concern. If we could just get more MPs in our House of Commons, it would be a better place. More Christian MPs in the House of Commons. Maybe we don't need more MPs. More Christian MPs in the House of Commons, it would be a better place. So if we could just get more people in positions of influence in education or whatever, we would change the world. The world would change by our being engaged with it. Can you see how each of those is subtly different? In fact, in one or two cases, radically different. And often what happens is people on those four trajectories, when you can choose where you stand, I know where I stand on there, or at least the way I lean, but we can choose where we stand, but what Tim Keller says in his book, helpfully, is we shouldn't fight people who stand in a different place. He points out, before I get onto that, that the two views at the top of the screen have a very high view of God's activity in the world, what's sometimes called common grace. Not specific grace, not saving grace, but general grace. God's way of running the world, God's kindness, God's presence everywhere. They have a very high view of that. The world is God's world, Psalm 24:1. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it, and all those who dwell therein. You know, they take that very, very seriously and say, well, if we're serving other people out there, we're serving God. Because God is everywhere and in everyone. And if we're helping run the institutions of the world, then we're serving God because God's in everything. There's a high view of common grace. Do you understand that? And at the bottom of the screen, on the opposite view, there's a fairly low or diminished view of common grace. Actually, the view would be more leaning towards 1 John's statement, the whole world is in the control of the evil one. You know, there's a sense of the world being an alien and a hostile place to Christians and to Christian thought and practice. And so we need to get out there and change it, or we need to live safely within it and model something to it. But the idea that God's already involved is probably less there. And I'm caricaturing these positions, but I think they are helpful in understanding there are different ways of engaging with culture. And Tim Keller says, oh, hang on, I've still got another line to go. Yeah, let's pay more attention to my screen. The other axis through the middle of the diagram there is that on the left, those two views are reasonably passive in influencing culture. They hope culture changes, but they don't go out on crusades to change it. They just hope it happens, either by doing their daily work in the Two Kingdoms view, or by forming a contrast society, a church, a distinct disciples. The other view, the other end of the pole, that axis, has a very high intention of influencing and changing culture. Both of those views really want to see things change and believe that that's what the calling of the church is, to change culture, to change the way the world is. And I suspect most of us have grown up probably, well, I don't know. No, I don't want to make that generalization. I don't want to make the generalization. Actually, thinking quickly on my feet there, I'm going to back off of that. Keller, this is where I'm finally finish my sentence. Tim Keller helpfully says, those four views each offer something positive to our thinking of how we engage with culture. And whichever line you're standing on, whichever direction you're facing, if you're facing the two kingdoms view or if you're facing the countercultural view, he said, don't stand looking at the end of the journey, stand looking back to the middle and appreciate the benefits of each of those four, which he says are that idea of just getting on and humbly and getting on and doing your job as well as it can and seeing what God does with that, what he calls humble excellence on that in the two kingdoms view. The idea of seeking the common good, the idea of wanting to be good and kind and generous and look after the poor and so on, that's a good thing, he says, in that view. So he's kind of bracketing out what the obvious weakness is, if you like, in each of the views and saying, let's look at what the good is in the view. In the bottom right-hand corner, he says that there's a very distinctive worldview that these Christians have here. They understand that there is a need for the church to engage with a fallen and broken world. And he says the strength, which is a weakness in some of the other views, the great strength in the bottom left-hand corner is this view of God's people, the community of Jesus Christ, King Jesus' family, and the priority and the importance of that. So he picks those things out and says these are all really important in the way that we engage with culture. But you can see that there are different ways of doing it. And in this church, I know through conversing with people without using diagrams or long words, I just know in talking to people that in our minds, we all perhaps hold slightly different views about how we should do that. And I think one of the good things about this church in many ways is that we kind of live with that as a positive rather than fall out on the differences in the main. But there is a tension, isn't there? This, all of this presupposes, with the exception perhaps of the relevance view, that there is a tension between church and culture. There is something distinct about church, and there is something different about world. And Jesus, I think, points to this clearly in a passage in John 17, in his great prayer, when he says and prays this, "Now I'm coming to you, Father. I told them, the disciples, many things while I was with them in this world, so they would be filled with my joy." Incidentally, that is the point of understanding what it means to live like Jesus, is to be joyful, not to make life harder. "I have given them your word, and the world hates them because they do not belong to the world, just as I do not belong to the world. I'm not asking you to take them out of the world, but to keep them safe from the evil one. They do not belong to this world any more than I do. Make them holy by your truth. Teach them your word, which is truth. Just as you sent me into the world, I am sending them into the world. And I give myself as a holy sacrifice for them so that they can be made holy by your truth." Can you see the sort of the tension there in what Jesus is saying? These followers of mine, Father, they've learned how to live distinctively. I've given them your word. I've taught them what it means to live how you want life to be lived. And people don't like it. In fact, they hate them because of that. But I'm not asking them to withdraw from the world and build a monastic community on the shores of Lake Galilee. I'm sending them into the world in just the way that I was sent into the world. And if we put the word culture in the same reading, it kind of, I think, just freshens it up and brings it alive a little bit. "I'm coming to you. I told them many things while I was with them in this world, so they'd be filled with my joy. I've given them your word, and their culture hates them because they do not belong to their culture, just as I do not belong to human culture. I'm not asking you to take them out of their culture, but to keep them safe from the evil one. They do not belong to their culture any more than I do. Make them holy by your truth. Teach them your word, which is truth. Just as you sent me into the world, I'm sending them into their culture. And I give myself as a holy sacrifice for them so they can be made holy by your truth." To me, that just kind of suddenly read very differently when I just slotted the word culture in there. And perhaps we're too used to some of the traditional wording of the Bible and it loses some of its freshness. And some of us will feel probably more comfortable with one half of that paradox than the other half. Some of us will feel awkward about the idea that we don't belong to culture and that culture is hostile to us as disciples. Others of us will feel uncomfortable with being sent into culture. We all react differently, don't we, to what Jesus has asked. But all I'm pointing out at this point is that there is what we're exploring here in these two sessions, there is this tension between our authentic life as disciples of Jesus Christ and the values and standards and expectations of the world that we live in. And I think when we don't feel that tension, I think we should reflect on our lives. Jesus said, "Woe to you when all people think well of you." If you fit in too easily, you need to start asking yourself, I need to start asking myself, why is that? If Jesus' view of disciples and culture is one of tension, and I just slot in so easily and naturally, is there an issue that I need to reflect on there? The great biblical illustration of all of this subject, I think, is the exile in the Old Testament, when God's people, Israel, were clearly pitched into an alien culture, Babylon. And suddenly you had the tension between God's holy nation and the very unholy nation of Babylon in which they had to live. And we know some of we can imagine perhaps some of the trauma of what it meant to be dislocated from everything that you know and placed somewhere else and to live there in fear and try to work out now, what does faith in Yahweh mean here in this world that doesn't appear to be Yahweh's at all in any least sense? And here's a picture of some people in exile hanging up their harps on the willow trees. Remember, our captors demanded of us a song. How can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? How do we function there? What does faith mean when we're here? And you may remember through the prophet Jeremiah the advice that was given to them. Settle down. Yes, settle down. Seek the good. Exactly. Yes. Well done. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses, settle down, plant gardens, eat what they produce, marry, have sons and daughters, find wives for your sons, so give your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there, do not decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I've carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. That's a very interesting mindset, I think, because you might imagine that their calling would be to pray against it, or to protest on the streets, or to try to tear it down in some way. But God says, get on with life, work, eat, have children, and do good. Seek the peace and prosperity of the place to which I've called you. Pray to the Lord for it. It's similar to what we're told in 1 Timothy, isn't it? That we should pray for people in authority in order that we may lead peaceful and godly lives. And Dave pointed out earlier when he was reading his notes from last time that some of the paradigm characters here, people like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who were actually high-ranking politicians in Babylon, but refused to cross the line when their faith was challenged by the culture in which they ended up living. So that was what we were thinking about last time. If you weren't here last time, you now feel caught up. If you were here last time, hopefully you understood it the second time round. I want to think from a still the same theme, but from a slightly different perspective. What we were thinking about then, and what I've just reminded you of, is the challenge of how we engage with culture. What I want to think about tonight more is the challenge of how culture affects church. So the flow of influence, if you like, is the opposite way. How does the culture we live in affect our church? And immediately, we can probably imagine that the risk is that our culture, the world that we live in, could compromise who we are and what we're supposed to be doing in the way that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and others were tempted to compromise their faith. I want to point you just for a minute to the opening chapters of the book of Amos in the Old Testament. You know, the book, little prophetic book of Amos. It starts with some denunciation. So here you are, as one of God's people, 9th century BC or so, living in Israel and Judah, knowing that you're God's people, surrounded by other nations or cultures. You know you're God's people. So you're not surprised when the prophet Amos pops up and starts denouncing from God, the practices of the surrounding nations. There's a set formula to the way he does it. For three sins of Damascus, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath. And then he pronounces the details of what Damascus or Syria have been doing that's upset God to the point of judgment. Then, for three sins of Gaza, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath. Gaza, where the Philistines come from, down there on the coast, also has been noted by God for being violent and unjust and dealing mercilessly with their enemies and the people around them. For three sins of Tyre, up there in Phoenicia on the coast again, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath. And again, they're denounced. Can you see what's happening to Israel at the moment? They're being surrounded. For three sins of Edom, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath. And then we're told what Edom has done wrong. For three sins of Ammon, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath. And we're told what Ammon has done. And then for three sins of Moab, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath. And as Amos is speaking this into Israel and Judah, they must be thinking, thank goodness for that. God's going to give them what they deserve. We've been fed up with that warring, violent, unjust lot on our borders. We're really pleased. And interestingly, notice, and here's another whole theme, God's concern for and interaction with the nations, which is something, were we to have a seminar on Brexit and the European Union, it would be interesting to pursue. But we're not. So forget that one. God and the nations outside of the church. God still has an eye on them and a concern for them, and they are still his nations. He is the God of the nations, and he still interacts with them. And the things that happen in those nations, whilst it might just look like a whole lot of warring Assyrians coming over the hill, is actually God's judgment. Things that happen in politics and in governments and in national affairs might look like very ordinary things that are happening, but they could be God interacting with the nations in the way that he does here. Anyway, that's an aside, which I wish I hadn't said. So, you're in Israel and Judah, and you're quite happy now. But the next thing that Amos says is, thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Judah, and for four, I will not revoke the punishment. Because they have rejected the law of the Lord, have not kept his statutes, they've been led astray by the same lies after which their ancestors walked. So I will send a fire on Judah, and it shall devour the strongholds of Jerusalem. Well, this is a shock in the text, if you're reading this in anything like, trying to put yourself in the situation of the first hearers. Why would God say that to Judah? They're his people. They're the holy nation. He brought them out of Egypt. They're his child. They're his vine that he planted. He loves them. But suddenly, in just the same way that God denounces the nations, God denounces Judah, the southern kingdom of Judah. And the reason is because they have not kept the law of the Lord, which, of course, the other nations weren't criticized for because they didn't have the law of the Lord. But they've been led astray by the same lies after which their ancestors walked. In other words, their ancestors walked in the ways of the nations. They'd compromised. They'd walked in the way of their cultures. So it gets worse because Israel are thinking, that's okay, Judah's got it in the neck, but we're safe. But no. Thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel and for four, I will not revoke the punishment because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. They who trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth and push the afflicted out of the way. Father and son go into the same girl so that my holy name is profaned. They lay themselves down beside every altar on garments taken in pledge. And in the house of their God, they drink wine bought with fines they imposed. Everybody's now being condemned by God because Israel and Judah have picked up the ways of the nation. The specific outworkings of the cultures are different. The surrounding nations are being criticized for the way they conduct warfare in the main, but it's about violence and injustice. And within Israel and Judah, violence and injustice is being wreaked in just the same way against the poor, against the dust of the earth, They're pushed into the dust of the earth, and the afflicted are pushed out of the way. Can you see how God's concern here is that you've just become like them? Okay, you've got your own way of interpreting what it means to be that, but you've just become like that. You've picked up the cultures of the nations around you. You're serving their gods, I think he says somewhere. You're serving their gods. Their idols are in your houses. So there's a real challenge, I think, that's laid down by this. But just for a minute, talk about those passages amongst yourselves just for 2 or 3 minutes. What do you think is the significance of Judah's and Israel's sin? What's the significance of them being on the list? And what does Amos's prophecy to Judah and Israel say to the church today, do you think, if anything? So some great minds here, and put them to work for a few minutes. Just find a few people near you who look like they might know the answers and attach yourself to them. Okay. I know some of you could talk all evening, but we haven't got the opportunity for that to happen, I'm afraid. So, I don't want to blow-by-blow account. Any quick bits of feedback from your conversation? Any particular insights you thought you had, or further questions that were posed? Yeah. So Steve said, we're not exempt from God's judgment. And I was going to say, if all this sounds very Old Testament and Old Covenant, I'll remind you of, firstly, Ananias and Sapphira, an interesting incident in which judgment started in the early church very, very quickly. And the letters to the churches at the beginning of the book of Revelation, some of which God says, if you don't shape up, if you don't stop giving in to those false prophets and those things that are happening, I will remove you from the lampstand. In other words, I will snuff out your existence as church. So in case we think, well, yeah, that was Old Testament, but now God's very different now. He's a much easier touch now. I would suggest the New Testament maintains this view of judgment being, you know, God is concerned about the state of the church, if I can put it in very simple terms. I'm going to move on because there'll be other chances to chat and feedback, and the clock's moving on if I don't. So the point I want to make next is that there are some good things and some challenging things in the way that we engage with culture, and we cannot help but for the culture we live in to shape the churches that we form. I want to read you a story. It's not a particularly interesting story, but I'm going to read it anyway. It comes from this book, which I'm fairly confident not many of you will have read. The Missionary Movement in Christian History, Studies in the Transmission of Faith, which looks at this whole issue of how do we transmit the faith into different cultures. And in his first chapter, he writes a story. It's an imagination exercise. Okay, so you need to exercise your imagination. Hope you came here to do that. Let's imagine a long-living, scholarly space visitor, a professor of comparative interplanetary religion, perhaps, who's able to get periodic space grants which enable him to visit Earth for field study every few centuries. Let's further assume that he wishes to pursue the study of the Earth religion, Christianity, observing the practices, habits, and concerns of a representative sample of Christians, and that he exploits the advantage he has over any earthbound scholar by taking his sample across the centuries. With it so far, you understand what you're being asked to do. Good. So let's assume, oh, here he is, by the way. Let's assume, if you've never seen a professor of comparative interplanetary religions before, now you'll know what to look out for. Let's assume his first visit is to a group of the original Jerusalem Christians about 37 AD. He notes that they're all Jews. Indeed, they're meeting in the temple where only Jews can enter. They still offer animal sacrifices. They keep the seventh day punctiliously free from work. They circumcise their male children. They carefully follow a succession of rituals and delight in reading the old books of law.
They appear, in fact, to be one of several denominations of Judaism. What distinguishes them from the others is simply that they identify the figures of Messiah, Son of Man, and Suffering Servant from the Old Testament law books with the recent prophet teacher, Jesus of Nazareth, whom they believe to have inaugurated the last days. They live normal family lives with a penchant for large, close families. They have a tightly knit social organization with many common meals taken in each other's houses. Law and joyful observance strike our spaceman observer as keynotes of the religion of Christianity. So he takes his notes, gets in his spaceship, and he goes back, all right? His next visit to Earth is in 325 AD. He attends a great meeting of church leaders, perhaps even the Council of Nicaea. The company... wondering what's funny about that. The company from all over the Mediterranean world and beyond it, but hardly one of them is Jewish. Indeed, on the whole, they're rather hostile to Jews. They're horrified at the thought of animal sacrifices. And when they talk about offering sacrifices, they mean bread and wine, used rather as it was in the house meals our observer noticed in Jerusalem. They do not have children themselves, since church leaders are not expected to marry. And indeed, most of them regard marriage as an inferior, morally compromised state. But they would regard a parent who circumcises children as having betrayed his faith. They treat the seventh day as an ordinary working day. They have special religious observances on the first day, but do not necessarily abstain from work or other activities. They use the law books that the Jerusalem Christians used in a translation, and thus know the titles Messiah, Son of Man, and Suffering Servant. But Messiah has now become almost the surname of Jesus, and the other titles are hardly used at all. They give equal value to another set of writings, not even composed when the Jerusalem Christians met, and tend to use other titles, Son of God, Lord, to designate Jesus. Their present preoccupation is with the application of another set of words of Jesus, words not to be found in either set of writings. The debate, and they believe it to be absolutely fundamental importance, is over whether the Son is homoousios with the Father, or only homoiousios with him. If that doesn't mean anything to you, don't worry. But take it on board as being the major concern of the first three centuries. The dominant factors which the outsiders notice as characteristic of these Christians are the concern with abstract ideas and theology, an intense intellectual scrutiny, an attempt to find precise significance for precise terms. He thinks of the Christians in the temple in Jerusalem nearly three centuries back and wonders what's gone on. Well, the best cure for his wonderment is his next visit to Earth when he pitches up three centuries later in Ireland. There are a number of monks gathered on a rocky coastline. Several are standing in ice-cold water up to their necks reciting the Psalms. Some are standing immobile, praying with their arms outstretched in the form of a cross. One is receiving six strokes of the lash because he did not answer amen when the grace was said at the last meal of brown bread and pulse. Others are going off in a small boat, in doubtful weather, with a box of beautiful manuscripts and not much else, to distribute themselves on islands in the Firth of Clyde, calling the astonished inhabitants to give up their worship of nature divinities and seek for joy in a future heavenly kingdom. Other monks are sitting quite alone in dark caves by the seashore, seeking no connection with them whatsoever. He ascertains from these curious beings that their beautiful manuscripts include versions of the same holy writings that the Greek fathers had used in his last visit to Earth. He notices that the Irish use the same formula that he heard being hammered out in Nicaea in 325. Somewhat to his surprise, however, they do not in general seem very interested in theology or very good at abstract thinking. They attach great importance to the date on which they celebrate their main festival, Easter. An outsider is most likely to notice their desire for holiness and their heroic austerity in quest of it. Can you see what the spaceman is getting here across the centuries when he's trying to work out what on earth is this thing going on earth called Christianity? How would you describe his research so far? Sorry? Flummoxing. Confusing. Sorry?
Is he really representative?
Well,
let's move on. Our spaceman delays his next visit until the 1840s, when he comes to London and finds in Exeter Hall a large and visibly excited assembly hearing speeches about the desirability of promoting Christianity, commerce, and civilization in Africa. They're proposing that missionaries armed with Bibles and cotton seeds be sent a distance of 4,000 miles to effect the process. They're also proposing a deputation to the British government about the necessity of putting down the slave trade, raising a subscription to promote the education of black mechanics, agreeing that letters be written, pamphlets and articles published. The meeting has begun with a reading from the same book, now in English translation, that the other Christians used, and there have been many other quotations from the book. Indeed, a large number of people in the meeting room seem to be carrying the book. On inquiry, the observer finds that most also accept, without question, the Creed of Nicaea. Like the Irish, they use the word holy quite a lot. But they're aghast at the suggestion that holiness could be connecting with standing in cold water, and utterly opposed to the idea of spending life praying in an isolated cave. Whereas the Irish monks were seeking to live on as little as possible, most of this group look remarkably well fed. What impresses the outsider is their activism and the involvement of their religion in all processes of life and society. Final visit to Earth is in 1980. I don't know if you remember this being reported on the news. But in 1980, he comes to Earth again, this time to Lagos in Nigeria. He goes there because now most Christians are African. So they are representative. A white-robed group is dancing and chanting through the streets on their way to their church. They're informing the world at large that they are cherubim and seraphim. They're inviting people to come and experience the power of God in their services. They claim that God has messages for particular individuals and that his power can be demonstrated in healing. They carry and quote from the same book as the Exeter Hall gentlemen. They say, on being shown the document in a prayer book, that they accept the Creed of Nicaea, but they display little interest in it. They appear somewhat vague about the relationship of the Divine Son and the Holy Spirit. They're not politically active, and the way of life pursued by the Exeter Hall gentlemen is quite foreign to them. They fast like the Irish, but only on fixed occasions. The characteristic which springs most readily to the spaceman's mind is their concern with power, as revealed in preaching, healing, and personal vision. Andrew Walls asked the question, back in his planetary home, how does our scholar correlate the phenomenon he's observed? It's not simply that these five groups of humans, all claiming to be Christians, appear to be concerned about different things. The concerns of one group actually appear suspect or even repellent to the others. How do we account for that? Sorry? Yeah, exactly, yeah. So there are some common themes, which Mel's picked up one, very good. Yep, since from Nicaea onwards, yes, yeah. So there's a core element of belief, the scriptures, and I didn't read you all of everything, but bread and wine and baptism are mentioned in most of them as well. But apart from that, they're hugely affected by the age that they live in. Hugely affected by the age that they live in. Andrew Wall says this, the visitor recognizes that these continuities, the significance of Jesus, the scriptures, the use of bread and wine and baptism, are cloaked with such heavy veils belonging to their environment that Christians of different times and places must often be unrecognizable to others, or indeed even to themselves as manifestations of a single phenomenon. We might think that today, looking around the world at people of different faiths, different expressions of Christianity, not different faiths, different expressions of Christianity, because our churches are necessarily culturally formed. They have to be. Just as Jesus had to manifest in first century Judaism as a Jewish male, the incarnation requires us to be wearing the same clothes, as it were, and talking the same language as the people who we're working with. So Andrew Walls talks about two different principles at work. One he calls the indigenizing principle, which says we're conditioned by a particular time and place And God accepts us as we are with our cultural assumptions in place. He doesn't wait to tidy up our culturally ingrained ideas any more than he waits for us to tidy up our behavior before he accepts us. So it's a very interesting and important statement. But we don't have to kind of shed all our cultural clothes before we're acceptable to God any more than we have to shed all our. He takes us as we are, and then we begin the process of changing and seeing things differently. So there's an indigenizing principle where we come and we accept that we can't help but be Western, most of us probably middle-class-ish kind of people with all of the assumptions and the values and stuff that brings. But he talks about a second principle, which he calls the pilgrim principle, which whispers to the Christian that he or she has no home here and warns him that to be faithful to Christ will put him out of step with his society. So this is back with John 17 again. Now, on the one hand, we are part of the world, we're sent into the world, we have to be like the world in order to communicate with the world. But we recognize that the world is not our home, and there's real tension between the two. And the challenge, of course, which is almost, it's a really difficult exercise, is to see your own culture. It's often been said, and I'm sure you can remember this illustrations used often, but it's no good asking a goldfish what water is like, because they've got no experience of anything else. That's the only life they know. You can't say, well, what would it be like? So a goldfish has to be really intelligent to actually try and think outside of the bowl, and say, yeah, I wonder what it's like out there. And for we intelligent human beings, it is possible, and it's required of us to think, what are the characteristics of the culture that we live in? Where can we accept, adopt, use, live comfortably within that? And where should we be pushing back, resisting, drawing the line across which we will not pass? So just think, I want to get more practical as the evening goes on. We're in the home straight. Imagine the space visitor came here. He's got another grant. What would he see, and what would he think our concerns were? And how much are our concerns shaped by our cultural context? Understand the question? Okay. I don't want anyone to lose sleep tonight. It's a bit like that thing at the end of Crime Watch, isn't it? Please sleep safely. There is no real space visitor coming into the room tonight. But just as an imaginary exercise, what would he think Christianity was all about if he came and observed us for a week? And how much of what's about us is culturally formed? So goldfish, get out of your bowls and look around. Okay, again, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to interrupt just to move things on. Any quick bits of feedback? Got the mic for anybody wants to say. Rachel?
Well, it might be the first time he's seen a woman, and it would be the first time he's probably seen a woman leading a service.
Okay, right. Good observation. Yes, in all those other visits, it would have been very male-dominated. That's an interesting observation. That would definitely go in the notebook, I think. Anybody else got anything that he would note? We were talking about something.
Bible, communion, salvation.
Oh, still you heard that. Okay. Yes. So the threads are still there. Anything else? Social concern? Yes. Death advice, those sorts of things. Yep, so concern to serve our neighbourhood. Yes.
In a way, I am an alien because I'm not.
Confession is good for the soul.
I know. So, as a sort of an occasional visitor, I would say that despite you might think that you're interested in like the social gospel, but I don't think you're just about that. So you're very interested in feeding the people who are. Perhaps spiritually poor as well as poor. So I see that as an outsider coming in,
okay.
That you're very interested in teaching the good news and speaking about Jesus. It's not just about lining their pockets and making them feel better. So I'd say you've got a bit of a blended thing going on.
Thank you. I've never had a real alien in my meetings before. That's great. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, Jill Mary, just one more, and then pass that back to Jill Mary, please.
I think this planet shaker would be concerned or unsure of why people's individual thoughts were not able to be always expressed because of the culture. For instance, something like abortion, which we don't talk about or pray about much as a church, but a lot of people individually would have their views. Mm. And I think because of the pressure of culture, we tend to play it a bit cool.
Okay, thank you. Interesting observation. Thank you. So the exercise is, I think, an interesting and helpful one. In working out how we do church and how we keep those essential threads running and how much latitude we have around them to do things differently. Last little section here is just thinking about some specific ways that our culture thinks and still thinking, well, how much of that do we bring into the church? And how does the way that society has moved on in its thinking and in its practices affect us? How does our culture in its thinking and its practices affect the way that we do church? So until the 1700s-ish, everyone thought that the world kind of stacked up like this. That God was the main character in the world. That through the church, which was very powerful politically and in every other ways, kings and nobles were influenced to rule over people who used animals, plants, and objects for their daily labor and sustenance. That, in a simple way, is what you might describe as a medieval worldview. That's the way the world worked. And so there were clear lines of accountability and expectation and duty to the people around you and above you and below you, indeed. And it was a very ordered system, and it ran like that for many centuries. Until the 17th century, 18th century-ish, when what's called the Enlightenment happened, and people began to think differently about the world. And again, just to put it simply, the Enlightenment worldview put the individual, the human individual, where God used to be. And reckoned that the human individual, without reference to God, had ample means to work out how to run the world of animals, plants, and objects, and to develop them and to make the most out of them for their own ends. Kings and nobles now were slightly suspect. Think French Revolution, for example. And the church became, and God became, an optional sideshow for religious people. And that world, in a very simplistic form, is the world that our culture lives in. And although we would want to tweak different words on the left-hand side of the screen, in some ways, that is the worldview that Christians live in. That God is still the supreme being who calls the shots, who has a people, who are the salt of the earth. Obviously, it's different in many regards, but there are similarities there, and you can see immediately the contrast between the two. Now, in his little book, the United Reformed Church minister, Leslie Newbegin, who is the most awkward name to spell, if you're a scholar and having to write his name, it takes you a long time to work out how many S's and how many B's and G's. Anyway, it's Leslie Newbegin. He was, I mentioned him before, if you remember, he was the guy who was a missionary in India and worked out how to share faith in India and do the cross-cultural stuff in India, came back to Britain expecting to come back to a Christian country and was shocked that actually the church was absolutely useless at sharing faith with its own culture. So he did a lot of thinking about how churches and Christians engage with their own Western culture. And one of his little books is called Foolishness to the Greeks, which is obviously a reference to biblical text. And he just summarizes a number of shifts that happens in the Enlightenment. The first is that whereas the world before had seen that the world had a purpose, it was here to glorify and serve God, when you bracket God out, the world doesn't have a purpose anymore. You can't talk about the reason for things. It's just got a bunch of stuff happening. It's a Newtonian physics, sort of. It's sort of just one cause and effect. One thing happens, another thing happens. You don't need anything outside of the box to make everything keep happening. And so the questions became, what's going on, not why is it happening? And science took a huge step ahead of faith at that point, because science could be developed to try and work out what was going on, but it never had to answer the question, and it cannot answer the question, why is it going on? He points out that the great thing that happened in the Enlightenment, I've already pointed to this, is that human beings became the center of their own world, human autonomy and reason. We can work this thing out. The beginnings of me culture and individualism. That I am an all-powerful, autonomous being, and you may not challenge me because I have power, ultimate power as a human being, to define all sorts of stuff about me, at least. Another thing that came out of this period was the creation of human rights. In the medieval world, there had been quite a complicated system of responsibilities and duties to those above you and to those below you. But coming out of this exaltation of the individual became this view of human rights, which is a relatively new invention. Just a few centuries old. Now, I'm not saying human rights is bad, but the big challenge about human rights is, who says so? Who says it's a human right? Well, another human being says it. Well, what if another human being disagrees with that being a human right? Then what do? Well, we fight over it, or we argue over it, or we elect governments to decide. But even then, you've still got a lot of people who say, that's not a human right because I don't believe it. So it's a challenging thing, human rights. When you bracket a higher authority out of humanity, who says anyone's got a right to anything? And it certainly put rights before responsibilities in human thinking. A loss of eternity as a reward meant that people had to seek all the rewards for life now. Medieval worldview had a space for an age to come, a world to come, heaven, paradise, call it what you will. And a great belief that in that age, God would put everything right. And for those that suffered in this age, they would be rewarded in the age to come. But when you lose that age, everything has to happen in the few short years you happen to be fortunate enough to be alive. And so if you want happiness, it cannot be deferred. You know, Hebrews, for the joy that was set before him, Jesus endured the cross. Well, if there is no joy set before you, you've got to get the joy now. You've got to be happy. So this narrative of happiness, this goal of being happy, of course, it's enshrined in the American Constitution. Everyone's got a right to happiness, the pursuit of happiness. And I want it all, and I want it now, because there is no one else to get it. And finally, the other belief that arises out of this view that life is very short, there's nothing beyond it, is that we need to keep improving things here and now. There's got to be this continual drive for improvement. We believe we're on an upward trajectory. Things are going to get better and better. They're on towards some kind of Marxist utopia. You know, we're on an upward hill to... But of course, things keep happening to make us think, actually, that's not true. Because things keep getting worse in some situations. And what we think is a really good thing rears around and bites us. The drug that we think is going to cure everything suddenly gives us deformed children. You know, that we think things are going to get better and better and better, but actually, they don't. Why do we believe it? Because it's a strong narrative of the culture that we've been brought up in. So this is the final one. The other big thing that came out of the Enlightenment was that there was a division between universal facts, which everybody must believe, and private values and opinions, which can be doubted or challenged. So again, the rise of science comes off the back of this. So what's really valued is if you can prove it's a fact. If something's a fact, it rises to a higher level. If we could only prove that Christianity was a fact, people would believe it.
because now it's got, and so there's a huge drive to sort of argue people into Christianity and to do apologetics to make it sort of very factual and scientific when it's not factual and scientific at all. So these are beliefs I put to you, and they've been developed and tweaked in various ways, but fundamentally this is what our culture and what I and you were brought up in school being taught. There was no lesson about the Enlightenment in my school, but all of these values came through the culture I grew up in very, very strongly. And the question is, how many of those can we live comfortably with? And how many of those are actually antithetical to the gospel? And what influence do they have on the church when you have a bunch of people who've been primed to think of the individual as the prime being in the universe? That has a huge effect on a church that's supposed to be a bunch of servants honoring one another and laying down their lives for one another. Thinking better of the other person than of yourself. When you have people been brought up to expect all their rights to be provided for them, talk of responsibilities is a real challenge. We're going to come on to some of these things as we close. I'm going to keep motoring. So that's a little bit about our culture's beliefs. But of course, there have been a whole bunch of societal changes as well, which affect church. Our culture has changed enormously in the years that most of us have done our growing up. Some of you are very young still and probably don't notice it so much. But old people like me, we notice how the world has changed. Stuart Murray, who some of you know, wrote a little book called Church in Post-Christendom. Church After Christendom, in which he sort of maps some of these social changes. See if you recognize any of these. That more complex family dynamics place considerable pressure on Sundays. Broken families, blended families, people with responsibility with parents that have moved away, things that weren't the case when I was young. Our culture has changed. People have got more disposable wealth and new horizons for leisure time. It's an interesting graph here. If you don't like graphs, just snooze for a couple of minutes. But some of you, your eyes will light up when you see my bar chart. Looking at Rachel here. This chart, which I'm going to put up, just to tell you what it is. It's about people taking holidays. The duration of holidays that people took in 1996 compared to 2016. Okay, so the thin yellow line, or orange line, is 1996, and the numbers along the bottom are the number of nights that people went away on holiday, yeah? And the numbers up the side are the numbers of people that took the holidays. So you can see from the yellow line, firstly, notice that nearly every point, it's lower, in some cases far lower, than the blue line, the blue bars. The blue bars is holiday taking now. So in other words, people are taking far more holidays than they used to. That's going to affect church, and doing church, and being in community together. But the big shift that's noted is the difference between the number of people who are taking a week, that's the seven-day holiday there, the big blue column, and a fortnight, which has not changed too much, but a little bit, 14 days away. Those are both changed, but what's risen is the number of people taking short breaks. Two nights away, three nights away, four nights away. You see? Taking weekends away. Heading off. I love to do that. So I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying that when you're doing church, when I grew up, you assumed that everybody would be there every Sunday. And that's how church works. People were committed. If they were on the children's rota, they would be there. The same person, can you believe this? The same person did the same Sunday school group every week. The same people were there doing the same things because, partly because they believed in church in that way, but largely because they'd been brought up in a world where there wasn't disposable wealth. My parents could only afford 1 week's holiday a year, and that was a struggle to save for. But now life has changed, culture's changed. And that change in culture will affect church. So, family dynamics, disposable wealth, changing patterns of work that both require increased time and commitment. That will change how we do church. Increasing commuting time. That precludes midweek availability. A lot of people in this church work away during the week. culture has changed. How do we do church with people that can't be here? What does commitment look like when you can't engage? Increased time given to children participating in extracurricular and social activities. Yeah, don't start me on that one. Okay, I'm just move on because I'm probably going to get into a lot of trouble if I start commenting on that one. But no, I won't. But it is a phenomenon, isn't it? Where children are being ferried to this club and this tutoring and that, you know, and that party, and they've got parents around their little finger, you know, every night of the week. In some cases. Involvement in community activities previously run by churches but are now independent of them. So churches used to run youth provision and da 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 da, and so by being involved in that, you're involved in your church. But now, lots of other organizations have started and people serve or view, and I'm not challenging this, they view the service of God as being in that, working in St. John's Ambulance or Red Cross or whatever. That's a cultural shift. Do you know the fastest, the biggest volunteer organization in Great Britain? No. Volunteer organization, yeah. Yeah. Or membership organization. Let me change that. It's the RSPB, Royal Society for Protection of Birds. They've got millions of members. But what does it mean to be a member? It means that you pay an annual subscription, get the magazine, and go looking for twites every so often. You know, it's is that a bird? Or maybe let's make that up. It is. Okay. Right. Okay. In other words, commitment looks very, very different now. So, in this changing social context, that's what our culture is for us, Monday to Saturday. And I think often, when we commented on what the space visitor would see, I wonder if some of those things would be things that he would spot as different from his previous visits, and what we do about them. Well, let's think about, to close, one of those things, very briefly. A major, major, if not the major, cultural belief system, which is in consumerism. Now, this is our culture. We are consumers. What's consumerism about? Firstly, consumerism is about choice. Choice lies at the very heart of the idea of being a consumer. We're bombarded with it every day, aren't we? Go to the shop to buy rice. I counted, when I shopped for rice a little while ago, 37 different sorts of rice. Why on earth does the world need 37? Why does Yate need 37? It doesn't. That's the answer. It does not need it. But there's got to be more choice, because more choice is what keeps drawing us back. Have you heard? There's a new one of them. It's about novelty. It's about saying, you can't make do with the old thing anymore, because our whole existence relies on you buying a new thing. And if you're happy with the old thing, we're going to go out of business. So we've got to create something that looks a bit novel. It still basically washes your clothes, but now it's got a little thing that you can put inside that, you know, whatever. So novelty, it needs to be new all the time. Abundance, there's got to be lots of it available. You've got to be able to go to the shops and find lots of stuff in there. Things have to go out as well, otherwise new things can't come in. There's an interesting quote. Whereas in previous generations, people outlived their objects, in our generation, have I got that right around? Thank you. I'm glad you're still listening. I'm impressed that you noticed I got it wrong around. Objects outlived their makers. Now the makers outlive their objects. Well, whichever way around it is, it was a good quote before I mucked it up. I've actually got it written down, which is even sadder. But anyway, you get it. Good. Thank you. Things come and go all the time. In fact, if things stay around too long, life is, big word, boring. And the biggest sin in our culture is to be boring. So I'm a big sinner tonight. So obsolescence. Fifthly, consumerism is the great, offers us the great promise of being happy. If you only look like this, you'd be happy. If you could only run 3 miles in 2 minutes, you'd be happy. Well, actually, you wouldn't. You'd be on a motorbike or something. But you can tell I'm trying to rush to finish, making less and less sense the faster I go. But you know, there's a strong happiness narrative which consumerism depends on. Why would we buy something if it wasn't going to make us happy? So we buy more and more stuff because we've been told the point of life is to be happy, and stuff makes us happy, right? Okay, well, some things do. Identity and meaning. So consumerism isn't just about utilitarianism. It's not just buying something that actually does something for me, but it's buying something that says something about me. Because I've got this, I am someone. And I have established my place in a certain group or a certain bunch of friends because I've now got the right trainers, or I'm driving the right car, or I'm living in the right area of town. I've finally got the house in the village, or whatever it is. We now have established a new identity for ourselves. We are successful. We are bright and young, even though we're not. But that's the myth. And of course, consumerism offers us a leisure activity. Consumption is no longer about a functional thing again, but it's actually, the whole business of sort of leisure therapy, shopping therapy, retail therapy. Thank you, I knew if I said it enough and I haven't done. Understand what I'm trying to say? Shopping has become leisure, a sphere of freedom. Now, think about those words: choice, novelty, abundance, old things going so that new things can come in, a desire to be happy, something that's going to establish identity and meaning for me, something that's going to fill my leisure time. Now, if we have been well brought up as consumers, when we bring all that to church, what is that going to say about our participation in church? Duncan McLaren in this book says, as people come to view religious outlets, that's his word for church, not as objects of loyalty and commitment, but as service providers there to meet their spiritual needs and wants, they will tend to make the same ideological assumptions about such outlets as they make about the marketplace at large. In other words, I'll go to the place that's going to give me most choice, most novelty, abundance of things that I want, that's going to give me identity and meaning and happiness. Now, that consumer cultural narrative played into church is, in my mind, deeply destructive of church. Because I'm old-fashioned enough to believe that church is about loving one another as I've loved you. It's about commitment. Sacrificial commitment to other people. And if it doesn't make me happy, well, tough. And if it doesn't make me a better person, then give me identity and meaning, then tough. And if there isn't a lot of choice, and we always sing the same songs, tough. Because my fundamental idea of church is not shaped by consumer culture, but most people's is. And there's a huge challenge for us when we're dealing with a consumer culture and people are trying to engage with us with that head on, without knowing they've got that head on. How far can we engage with the culture, to go back to Andrew Walls, as an indigenizing principle? How far can we take some of this on board? And churches do, so you get churches with sort of rock concert-like displays and lasers and you know, trying to tap into a certain generation. Quite sensibly, they tap into this culture to try and engage. But at what point do you actually stop engaging with the culture and start condoning the culture? That's the challenge. To go back to the words on the screen at the beginning, if the job of the church is to create a counterculture, there's a different way of living than a consumer lifestyle. How do you do that without appearing to be irrelevant and detached? Anybody want to be a church leader? Put your hand up now. Because that's the challenge. That's a big challenge. That's the big challenge. How do we engage and remain distinct? How do we talk to our culture without being swamped by it? Where do we draw the lines? Well, with those questions, I'm going to acknowledge that time has defeated us. But if we'd had time, I would have liked you to deal with those questions and to think about those words, again, in your experience of local church here or in other places, and to ask the question, what difference does it make that we live in this consumer society? What difference does it make the way we do things? And are we drawing the lines in the right places? Are we helping people detox from consumer culture, or are we simply really replaying it to them with a Christian veneer on it? On that blessed thought, I'm going to shut up and say thank you for living with it and staying with it. And more questions. Thank you, it's very kind of you. But there's more questions than answers, because I don't know what the answers are. No, there is no third version. There's no third on this. But I really would like to be part of a church that's wrestling with these questions. Because I think, in terms of just stepping out of this a minute, you know, in terms of Thornbury Baptist Church in 10, 20, 30 years' time, it's going to have to have accommodated to culture in some way, because culture will keep moving on. And at the moment, it's a sense which many churches are still trying to do church with the expectations of people living in the 1950s and 60s. This kind of church worked brilliantly at a certain time in history. And it still works today, but it works less well for an increasing number of people. And so I think there are big questions to be asked for the future of Thornbury Baptist Church. To say, how do we keep this presence of distinctive Christianity alive and well in the town of Thornbury? Not as a museum to some past age, but as a real living example that people can understand and engage with in a changing culture. Those are the big questions.